Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Omar El-Tarai, your host and director of research at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund level intelligence. I'm excited to say we have a special guest on with us today, Justin Pinckney from AEW. Justin Pinckney is head of private debt at AEW and portfolio manager for AEW's debt separate accounts and commingled fund. He is a member of AEW's debt investment committee. Prior to joining AEW in 2022, Justin was a principal with Mercer Alternatives, where he served as head of private debt North America and was a member of the Private Debt Investment Committee and Ratings Review Committee. Previously at Mercer, Justin served as a lead researcher within North American real estate and as a consultant on select client relationships. And before Mercer, Justin was the deputy chief investment officer with Michelin North America. Justin started his career as an underwriter for commercial real estate and lower middle market commercial and industrial lending at First Citizens Bank. Justin graduated from Wofford College and is a CFA charter holder. Justin, so glad to have you on with us. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Omar. That is a very thorough background. I appreciate it. It's great to be with you.
Well, to start off, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got started on your career path?
Yeah, as you can probably tell, I've gone from bank training, from LP all the way to the GP side. So I've had a few great stops along the way, and I think a lot of training that's gone along with it. But I think the two common themes throughout have been credit, and they have been on portfolio management. So, you know, having the opportunity to go through a training program at a bank was very helpful to start the career. Pursued my CFA charter while I was there. And basically, after immediately receiving that, you know, found a home in Michelin North America. So Michelin, global tire manufacturer. I was one of a small number of people that did something that, you know, the vast majority of people at the company didn't do, and that was manage their pension assets. But there, you know, it was a pretty traditionally focused liability-driven investing framework. High funding ratio, very credit-oriented, a pretty healthy allocation to real estate. And there it was basically, you know, going out and continuing to close the funding gap, continuing to partner with world-class managers in order to find opportunity to deploy those pension dollars. And then transition into Mercer, where I spent about half the time on real estate and the other half of private credit. And again, a great learning opportunity in each one of those, but I think it's transitioned well into my current role.
And were you drawn to commercial real estate? Or, I mean, the CFA charter is pretty broad in nature. The bank training and really focusing on C&I is one aspect. But was this something that you were actively going towards CRE? Or it is just a large enough asset class that you were spending half your time and then committed kind of full time to?
No, real estate was always the goal. I mean, it really goes back to like high school. I was like interning at an appraisal shop. So I think that's always been the driving force. And again, real estate's also been a pretty big focus for each one of these. That was the majority focus at First Citizens. It was a big part of our portfolio at Michelin, where that was just more broad training about how to be an allocator and getting great, you know, exposure to all asset classes globally. So I felt that both of those were just great training ground and then allowed me to transition initially into Mercer as a role within the real estate team. There was an opening to lead the private credit function within North America. So I raised my hand and that was a lot of fun because that asset class was developing rapidly. Allocators were increasingly adopting it as part of their portfolios. And then when AEW called, it was, you know, a shop that I had known and admired for some time. And I think they were looking for someone with a background very comparable to mine that had spent time as an allocator, that had spent time as in a consulting seat looking at real estate and also knew a fair amount about credit. So there's probably like four or five of us. So I think they probably just struck out with the other four and they were left with me.
Could you speak a little bit more towards your role and how it fits into AEW as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. So AEW has been active in credit really since the beginning. We have more formally established a debt platform, if you will, after the global financial crisis, like many of our competitors have. That was a time when banks were withdrawing from the market and a lot of our peers also saw the opportunity to now provide credit as more of a strategic asset allocation for investors, as opposed to something that was tactical that investors did when it made sense, when it offered very high absolute returns. And we followed suit like many of our peers and really started to be a participant constantly as opposed to tactically. I joined in 2022, about 11 years into the debt platform. They were fortunate to have a couple of separate accounts with great long-term partners and then stepped in to help manage those portfolios. And then my day-to-day beyond that is really to help build on what are great roots here within AEW broadly and specifically within credit. So looking to continue to expand what we're doing within credit across the risk spectrum, and then ultimately looking to find the right investment partnerships with world-class allocators. So we continue to be a focus on raising a commingled fund and ultimately expanding our business through separate accounts strategically as well. So day-to-day varies. It could be as simple as going out and helping fundraise with our investor relations team. What we do on the credit side is pretty structured. So one day it's asset management, the next day it's originations. We have people that lead each of those functions, but you know, being an active team participant and then really focusing on the direction of the business. So it's a lot of fun. Each day is a little bit different than the last. And obviously we continue to be exposed to the markets, which continue to surprise in a lot of different directions. So thinking thoughtfully about how we're approaching those markets today and what we'll be doing in a few years, I think is really an honor to be a part of.
Are you focused predominantly on originating new credit, or is it on buying existing?
Yeah, originating new loans. Yeah, so we're active across mortgage lending and subordinate debt and its direct origination, typically the single lender in place with a single borrower. And that has been really what we've done since the beginning. We're not typically out buying debt, not that we're opposed to it. Of course, the opportunity could arise. We're buying loans off of another investor's balance sheet, whether it's a bank, an insurance company, or another debt fund. But I think all else equal, our preference is always to control the loan docs, control the relationship with the borrower, and really own that relationship from start to finish. So yeah, we're typically out in the market sourcing opportunities from direct from sponsors, from brokers, or with co-lenders, banks or insurance companies typically. So I think we're pretty guarded in the types of borrowers that we like to do business with. We like them to be aligned with us, and we like that they have proven execution capabilities for whatever they're borrowing the money for, whether it's construction or a renovation project, or even something that's more or less stabilized. And so I think, you know, we're fortunate to have relationships with a lot of great borrowers, and it's our goal to can continue on with that same path and the direct origination side.
And are you focused on any portion of the capital stack? Do you have a primary focus on either being in certain positions in the capital stack or property types or markets?
We have a variety of different capital sources, so it depends on the account, obviously. Right. But no, we're active really across everything from whole loans through preferred equity. It just depends on what each investor is looking for. So the great news is we do have capital typically to approach the market and more specifically to approach borrowers and to fill whatever need that they have. We are active across most property sectors, not all, but we're active effectively where AEW as a whole is on the equity side. And that's property sectors, that's markets. And so that tends to be the top 25 most liquid, deepest markets in the country. And in the property sectors, of course, maybe we haven't been emphasizing some over the last few years. It's the typical four main food groups, plus things like senior housing. And then growing deeper into exploring things like self-storage, student housing, where AEW more broadly has been adopting those more recently.
Fantastic. I guess you're assessing every opportunity on a kind of individual level, as opposed to having this kind of like broad theme that you're willing to put out money towards. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, we like to be pretty selective. I think what the markets have, what they continue to teach us is that, especially in credit, like avoiding mistakes is paramount to success. And that's really been also pretty critical on the equity side as well, just like avoiding sectors in secular decline. Not that there's not opportunities everywhere with all the time across sectors, but yeah, we are basically on the bottom up side underwriting each investment individually. We have a very well-resourced research function, so we use the top-down, but ultimately we are looking inward at our own acquisition professionals, our own asset managers. And then because we're active in the markets where we own and operate property now, we think it results in a pretty thorough underwriting profile for each of our deals, where we don't have to just go to the major data providers in order to tell us what's going on in those markets. We're going to our own portfolio and our own experience in these markets to know where should we be, what business plans are achievable, what rents are achievable, what margins are appropriate to underwrite at stabilization. And I think that just helps give us more insight relative to doing this more passively.
That makes sense. And so, looking back at your time at AEW, as well as maybe if they were on your radar before you joined, how would you describe the firm and the private debt function in terms of over the last really 5 years or so? Have you been seeing AEW really playing kind of offense, defense? There's been a lot in the markets, and I know firms have had to shift a few times over the last 5 years, but how would you characterize that period?
There's a lot that's happened in the last 5 years, right? We've gone from 5 years ago, basically now, from the start of a pandemic through an ultra low interest rate environment to spiking interest rates to stress across the cash flows of a lot of property types. And I think what we've tried to do is just evolve with the markets and to be very thoughtful about how we're allocating dollars on behalf of our clients. I would characterize what we've done since I've been here as being a little bit more risk off in 23 and 24. There was a period of repricing, obviously. Altus, you know that better than anyone. As you see the data coming in from a number of groups that look just like us, but no secret that rising interest rates have had an effect on collateral values across real estate broadly, kind of despite what's been going on fundamentally, which has more or less been pretty positive for the in-demand sectors. And so we saw the repricing happening, and we ultimately decided to upgrade in credit quality and focus really on the best borrowers, the best markets, and creating brand new product. And how we did that might sound a little ironic, but we did that through construction lending, which on the surface seems like, well, isn't that an opportunistic type of risk profile? And you know, if you're looking at it from an equity lens, then it certainly can be, especially if you're accompanying that with some form of leverage. But what we did on the lending side is really curtail our advance rates. And so partnering with world-class borrowers, again, in these great markets, you know, we felt was an appropriate move at the time, because one thing we didn't know was the extent of the repricing that would happen, the extent of interest rates, how high they would rise, but we can control what we do on our advance rates. And one of the areas where you can still maintain a very healthy spread, so I think limiting your risk profile, was in construction lending at the time. Specifically, we looked at industrial construction lending because that tended to offer the best risk-adjusted return in our view. But when I say we were curtailing our advance rates, think loan-to-cost ratios somewhere in the 45 to 55% range, where you're ultimately lending near land value. So we saw that as a great opportunity. And then the other piece was, these tend to be shorter term loans, right? You know, nobody likes construction debt outstanding for a long period of time. It tends to be more expensive. It tends to be more onerous in terms of the demands that are placed on the borrowers. And so they have a huge incentive to refinance us at the earliest possible time. So, you know, we think putting those dollars out in that investment theme really played out very well. And we're already starting to see those assets go up for sale. And we think we're going to start seeing some realizations from those pretty soon, which allow us to redeploy that capital into new themes. So from defense to offense, the repricing is largely complete, we think. And so, you know, now we think this might be a time for playing a little bit more offense. And again, we're going to approach the market very tactically and thematically, because we think that is a way to find those opportunities with the best relative value and really lean heavily into those. And so right now we are seeing opportunity in senior housing. It's a sector that AEW has been in for more than 25 years. We own, I think, more than 10,000 units today. And it's something that we know. It's something that demands a specialist touch. And what we see on the relative value side is, of course, we like the spread profile today, but we really see a demand for that capital and then a lack of lenders that are able to supply it. The traditional lenders typically size to a debt service coverage ratio 1.2, 1.3. And the product that's delivered since COVID happened, which is a lot of product, brand new Class A facilities that we think will be in demand for a number of years, are just not to the point where they have stabilized their operations yet. They need a shorter term bridge loan in order to get from point A to point B, which is when they can either sell the property or find permanent takeout financing. And in the middle, we think you are accessing a sector where we have relationships, where we can find deal flow, and you're finding a much better supply-demand picture than you have in many years for senior housing. So the demand with the silver tsunami is actually here now. I know it's been talked about for a decade or more, but it actually is here now, and the math backs that up, and we're seeing that reflected in rising occupancies. And at the same time, supply is now more limited than it has been quite a while. That's lining up well, and it's leading to great things at the NOI, at the property level. So we're seeing NOIs expand double digits last year. We project that again this year. I think if you looked at a lot of the market data, that is a profile that looks like it will continue at least for a few more years. So you're actually seeing the stars align, we think, in many ways for this to be a great risk-adjusted return for investors.
And do you have a preference? Seniors is a pretty diverse sector, given that you have a kind of spectrum of operating models in place, whether it's you're looking at a skilled nursing facility versus independent living versus assisted right. living versus memory care. Is there any subtype in there that the thesis fits better for or that you have a preference for?
I would say our preference is sticking to our knitting in investing where we have those relationships and where we have expertise than the ability to underwrite and where we ultimately have the ability to asset manage. And if business plans really go off plan, where we have the ability to intervene and ultimately own those properties. So that tends to be class A, 100% private pay, full continuum of care properties or senior housing communities. So a component of independent living that transitions to assisted living, that ultimately can transition to memory care. We like that profile because that's where we found success historically. And so we continue to, again, I think stick to our knitting and not try to be something that we're not and try to push into new realms on the credit side before we fully understand the operations from having been an owner for a number of years. So again, there's plenty of opportunity there today, sticking with what we've done historically. Because there are a number of, I think there's $10, $11 billion of maturing loans this year. And again, most of those loans will not size to a permanent takeout financing. And the operations aren't stabilized enough yet where the owners are motivated to hit the market for a sale. So I think we're looking at this as something that's tactical in nature because it's not going to be the situation that we're still leaning into 2 years from now. Because at that point, a lot of these properties will have stabilized and they will have refinanced or sold.
Thank you for the color there. If we turn attention to essentially what's happening in the markets, at least over the first quarter of 2025, how would you characterize like CRE debt? There's been a lot of excitement, but this year so far has been marked with quite a bit of volatility as well. So
yeah,
what's your recap, at least of the first quarter?
Should we mention that we're recording this on April 3rd, the day after Liberation Day?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
These comments are certainly going to be reflective of Q1 and who knows what's going to happen in Q2. But as you know, I mean, there's been quite a bit of volatility. We've seen short-term rates obviously stay the same ever since the Fed dropped rates and really basically the fourth quarter of last year. But we've seen longer-term rates swing around quite a bit. I think they are now down about 75 basis points from their peak in early January. And I don't know, as you look from Q4 of last year to Q1 of this year, Q4 was, I think, in many ways characterized with a recognition that the bottom was potentially in for the repricing episode. It took about 8 quarters. They always tend to take about 8 quarters. And you saw the first print within the Odyssey Index of the positive number that you had in quite a while. So I think there was a lot of optimism that there was going to be declining short-term interest rates, a still positive economic environment, still relatively positive fundamentals, and then a repricing that you felt comfortable that the bid-ask spread had narrowed enough to create more transaction volume, which I think the market is really needed for a period of time now. And then you transition into Q1, rates continue to go higher on the long-term side. And I think some of that optimism was then clouded a bit to the point where, okay, is there really the opportunity that we thought we had? It seemed that in many cases, there was a developing theme of the haves and have-nots. And that goes to both sectors, and it also goes within sectors. Let's take multifamily, for instance. There are haves that still trade for pretty tight cap rates. And when the 10-year was spiking to 4.7, 4.8, and you're looking at a multifamily trade that is inside of that, you really start to question, are you going to be able to grow NOI sufficiently to make that a good purchase or not? Versus the have-nots that maybe have 10, 15 years of age that are stabilized, but maybe they're not in the absolute premier location and the premier market and the premier product for that market. And those have-nots, there was a pretty attractive spread, I think, between those two. And so I think what we do here is just try to question, you know, where are we placing capital? There are certainly opportunity in the have-nots, but I think chasing the theme entirely is probably short-sighted because the haves are haves for a reason. I mean, they are a premier product. I think they will be able to grow NOI in many cases better than market. And so we continue to just see maybe a divide between those sectors, those assets that have liquidity and those that do not. And that is the case for credit as well. And you can see it in your own survey, right? There are respondents that overwhelmingly like a particular flavor of multifamily. And then there are a very few lenders in other sectors like office or senior housing or hospitality or construction. And so there are still pockets of relative value everywhere you look. And to us, we try to cast a pretty broad net and just bring in deal flow of a variety of different types, a variety of different business plans, and then use our judgment that as being an active market participant as to where to place those client dollars, because we don't want to turn our back on any sector, any asset, just because it's the vogue thing to do at any given point in time.
That makes sense. And sticking on markets, and you mentioned the survey that we just put out the results. And as a reminder, we're recording this on the 3rd of April. So when you're hearing this, that survey will have been out for a little bit longer than that. But you were speaking to what was happening with treasuries. But if you look into the kind of corporate space, we have been seeing quite a bit of spread widening in the last couple of weeks of the first quarter. I think that's driven by sticky inflation prints and concerns around like resurgence of inflation, as well as tariff talks and overall uncertainty around trade policy has really decreased growth expectations. You've seen some reversal from some of those themes that you've touched on that we're seeing throughout 2024. Through the first quarter, corporate credit spreads widened across that credit quality spectrum from about 10 basis points for the AAA and AA, or the highest rated credit, to 180 basis point widening for high yield. But if you compare those corporate spread movements to what we saw in the Altus Group's debt capital market survey, I think you're starting to see how commercial real estate credit is being treated a bit differently. Right. So we did see some widening, but to a lesser extent than what we saw in the corporate bond space across many different property types and financing products and different leverage points. Specifically, spreads widened for lower leverage, short duration, fixed rate, retail, hotel, industrial sectors broadly, as well as the subsectors of life science, medical office, and SFR, or single family rental. But you also saw some spread narrowing across sectors, for particularly for the floating rate products, which I thought was quite notable. You saw spread compression in residential, industrial, office, and retail. And that was true at both lower and higher leverage attached detached points. So the picture looks a bit more mixed for commercial real estate, but actually it's mixed in a good way when compared to some of the corporate credit spread movement that we've seen. You know, you've seen the results from the Q1 survey. Did you have a different takeaway? Were you focused on anything else?
Yeah, to your comment about corporate versus spreads on privately originated real estate loans, I think the starting point is really important to note too. The starting point on a lot of these corporate issues was about as tight as it's ever been. I think until you got out to the single B minus, triple C plus range, you were in the top decile of credit spreads that you've been in ever. And these are long time series of data. The combination of high yields and investor demand for that yield had shrunk, and then a positive economic environment too. Yeah. And I think rising earnings for a lot of these corporate issuers, you know, led to very, very tight spreads. And so, yes, you are seeing a widening off of that, but it's still, I think in the bigger picture, I don't know that you can quite compare the two apples to apples, because real estate credit is still tightening in some areas, but it's off of maybe not historically wide, but certainly above average loan spreads. And that had pretty much everything to do with our conversation earlier of like, of course, you should demand more as a lender when there's less liquidity and when there's more concern about the repricing environment. So of course, like any lender would want more compensation for their dollars in that environment. So I think now that you're seeing a little bit more stabilization within real estate, yes, you are seeing a little bit of spread tightening. That's been our experience as well. as a group that tends to focus more on the bridge lending space. We think there are pockets where it is still wide relative to history. But I think to your question on what stood out to me on the survey, yes, the areas like multifamily in that 66 to 75% LTV range, those have tightened some, right? Especially if you look back over the past 18 months, they've tightened quite a bit. But what's also tightened and what you also see on the survey is the bank repo pricing. And I think that has been the catalyst that allowed whole loan spreads from a lender's perspective to tighten along with it. Banks withheld and held out for some time on tightening those repo spreads. But as those come in, it allows those whole loans to pass on some of those savings to borrowers. And so it is a lower cost environment for borrowers. That's great. That helps hopefully promote more transactions. But what it does is because in many cases, those loans on multifamily properties are being pledged as collateral against a repo facility or against a note on note, it still allows those lenders to offer high single digit yields to their end investor. So I think their end investor is probably not seeing a tremendous difference in their yield profile, which is a positive, but there are some changing dynamics within kind of the whole loan versus repo side. So kind of tightening altogether, better for borrowers. But at this point, I think it's still an attractive yield profile that many investors are drawn to.
So earlier this year, you published a piece called Searching for Gold, Strategies for Navigating Debt Opportunities in Uncertain Times, in which you call out a number of pretty major themes that ultimately lead to a conclusion or that CRE debt looks quite attractive on a relative basis and beneficial to portfolio construction. Can you speak a bit about that piece? Why did you write it? And what are some of those key themes that are making CRE debt look attractive?
Yeah, so I felt compelled to write it because we're constantly getting questions about where does commercial real estate credit belong in a portfolio? I think it can belong, and what we've seen even from our own clients is that many of them place it within fixed income portfolios, some place it within private credit portfolios. And obviously there's a long history of real estate allocators placing it within real estate portfolios, whether they see an opportunity tactically in order to get higher risk adjusted returns temporarily, or whether they just demand a higher yield overall from their portfolio to offset maybe something they're doing elsewhere within real estate. So I wrote it to address and really titled it as such because private credit has been the flavor, not of the week, the flavor of the decade, probably. I think you certainly see a lot of momentum there. Post-COVID, you had no shortage of newspapers and investment managers calling it the golden age. And so some of the searching for gold is certainly aligned with that theme of a golden age for private credit. I think right now you are also seeing a shift from your traditional direct lending model. So your kind of middle market corporate direct lending with borrowers with $25 to $100 million of EBITDA. And you're seeing a bit of a shift, which has been a very attractive trade if you look at the data. And you're seeing a shift now to more of a focus on asset-based lending. And again, I think you're seeing a lot of the same investment theses across that spectrum as people move to diversify portfolios from purely a corporate focus to something that can offer a little bit more. Maybe it's royalties, maybe it's real estate, maybe it's aviation finance. But the whole point was to maybe take a closer look at the asset-based finance market. And then one, recognize that it's massive. I mean, it's $26 trillion market by some measures. And then look at where maybe the opportunity may be and may not be. Obviously, we're biased. You know, we're a commercial real estate shop. That's all we do. So take it with a grain of salt, if you will. But I think if you look at the big major categories within that, it's residential mortgages, it's consumer loans, like credit cards, auto loans, and then it's commercial real estate. And commercial real estate is a $6 trillion component of the overall asset-based finance market. And all we did was try to look and say, of those big three opportunities where scale exists, which is most likely to offer investors a recurring kind of secular opportunity? And we make the case for commercial real estate. We wouldn't be writing the paper otherwise, but we think it offers attributes to portfolios regardless of where you're placing this within your overall asset allocation framework that investors may want just to remind themselves of. And I boiled it down to credit quality, because you are backed by hard asset collateral versus something that may not have as a reliable of a value during a liquidation scenario, like accounts receivable or inventory or general like FF&E. You have a more reliable collateral value, we think, in a liquidation scenario. So you tend to be rewarded with higher credit quality as you evaluate these credits. and especially versus the leveraged finance corporate universe. That tends to be a B-rated implied credit rating. Commercial mortgages on real estate tend to be higher. They're often investment grade. You have seen historically an attractive illiquidity premium, which is proven out through a variety of different benchmark measures. And we think that's something that will continue to occur. You have diversification. So a different underlying demand drivers than what you would typically see in the corporate universe, which will be inherently and highly correlated with just general economic conditions. There's certainly components of that within real estate, but I don't think you can canvas real estate entirely and say GDP down, real estate bad. I think there's more nuance there. So you get diversification, and the historical return streams also prove that out. And then you also get different control elements, which I think are important. Ultimately, as credit investors, our number one goal is to avoid loss and provide a recurring, reliable yield to investors. And we think that those control elements help avoid loss better than in many other sectors of lending. So we make the case for that as well. But overall, I think now that this collateral repricing event looks to be largely complete and that interest rates remain high, I think loan spreads still remain attractive relative to history. I think now is just a really interesting time to be looking at commercial real estate lending with a fresh set of eyes. So that's all it was, to draw attention to that and to make sure that it has its place within private credit allocations, because we think it's certainly can serve a number of different benefits to portfolios.
I know that the retreat of banks has been a big opportunity opener for the non-bank lenders in this space. Is that something that we've started seeing some banks get back, come back to the market, but then we've also seen just tremendous non-bank interest in the space? Is there any risk of crowding out, or is this something that you think can last for a while because ultimately the banks are not flooding back into the space?
Oh, I think it can last a while. The banks are still very much present, but it's different than it has been in the past. I mean, now it's more of a partnership model with the debt funds, where they are financing portfolios of loans as opposed to going out and independently originating all of the loans directly to these borrowers. So they've transitioned from mortgage holdings on balance sheet to repo finance or note on note finance. So we'll just generically call it portfolio finance. And it's a totally rational thing why they've done that. They get better capital treatment from regulators. They make more money, so their return on equity is much higher. And let's face it, it's much more operationally efficient to give a loan supporting 100 underlying mortgages than it is to go out and individually originate those mortgages yourself. So we think it makes sense. And now, instead of having a very large, very low cost of capital competitor in the market, you have a partner. And you can jointly approach the market and say, hey, you know, we've got this borrowing facility with bank X, Y, or Z. They're well capitalized. They know the space. And it allows the banks to continue to put dollars out in an asset class that has historically served them well. But it's just in a different wrapper, if you will. So we think it makes a lot of sense. But yes, I would agree. We have seen less bank involvement on the mortgage side. Doesn't mean it's totally erased. And I think you see the data bearing that out as well. So even in a low transaction volume market, you've still seen the bank share of non-agency originations go from something about half in 2022. And then towards the end of last year, it was under 20%. So the data is bearing that out. And again, keep in mind, that's with transaction volume. That's just fallen off a cliff. It's down 60% or so from its heights in the more recent past. It's hard to say what banks will do moving forward, but I think we can all agree that the regulatory environment's probably going to be more relaxed. So who knows? But I do think that a lot of these banks are really emphasizing repo lending as opposed to mortgage lending. So we're excited about looking to them as partners. I mean, AEW has been a big borrower within commercial real estate for 40 years. We're fortunate to have a lot of great relationships with money center, super regional, and regional banks. So partnering with them to put out a loan program makes a tremendous amount of sense. Hopefully they see us as a credit enhancement and, you know, somebody they want to do business with. And that will only result in, I think, a better overall offering to investors.
And so you've done an excellent job of articulating and really laying out the opportunity within the CRE credit space. How well is that landing with clients and investors? Are certain points sticking better than others?
Yeah, I think so. I think the big change is that regardless of your return bogey, credit broadly now has more of a representation in your portfolio than it likely has in a very long time. We still have short-term base rates of 4.25 to 4.5. You add on that, even an unlevered spread that you could still get in the 2.50-3% range in some cases, maybe more, depending on the sector that you're lending to. And you're adding it up with the origination fee, and you're at a 7% plus yield profile. Most allocators on the pension side, on the insurance side, maybe even some endowments that don't need to hit as high of a return bogey, see that as offering good relative value because you can take theoretically less risk than being in the equity side of regardless of the underlying asset class. And you've got, I think, more certainty, right? You know, you've got yield, right? You're not relying on a residual value to help create your return profile for you. You're getting that quarterly. And so I think allocators increasingly are adopting credit, regardless of the flavor of credit. And you've seen that in the private credit allocations. You've seen insurers be the ones that have really stepped in and taken on market share from the banks within real estate lending over the past 2 years. That's been a healthy signal that I think that there is opportunity. And when you can earn those types of yields on an unlevered basis, as long as that continues, I think you'll continue to see allocators favor that over something with maybe higher return potential, but certainly more uncertainty with things like private equity or even public equity in some cases.
And what do you think will differentiate the leaders from the pack in terms of the capital allocators who are getting into this credit space?
Real estate is still a relationship business. I mean, I think AI is coming for some jobs, but I'd hate to say that it's coming for our jobs tomorrow. I do think it matters who your lender is. I do think it matters who your operating partners are. And I think in many cases, having those relationships that have accrued through a lot of market cycles pays dividends in times like these, where I think borrowers increasingly place an emphasis on certainty of execution. And knowing that they will have a partner who understands their business plan and can underwrite it along with them. And that will be there through the thick and thin time. So I think that increasingly holds value. And I think, of course, we're biased, but I think if this recent period has taught us anything, that having a firm that has workout capabilities is critical to success long term. It is just another tool that you can use in order to preserve value for your loan portfolio. So having the ability to step in and own property just allows you to have a more favorable negotiating stance relative to a challenged, distressed, or a distressed credit. So I think those groups that, you know, one that can that have big equity platforms will see very good deal flow because they've got the relationships. They'll be able to underwrite it more effectively because, again, you're not looking at broad market data in order to create your insights. You're looking inward at your own portfolio and what you're seeing boots on the ground within those markets and within those assets. And I think on the asset management side, it just allows you to have much closer conversations and more in tune conversations with borrowers during the hold period so that if something goes off plan, you're having a conversation about it early and hopefully rectifying it versus heading ultimately for a default situation, which nobody wants. So I think just, again, those groups with large equity platforms that have an established credit business will probably be in for their fair share of wins moving forward.
That makes sense. And one final question that we like to ask all our guests, if you could snap your fingers and have any change come to the industry, what would that be?
I think there's two I'd like to mention. They kind of go hand in hand, but one for the credit side would be a common valuation methodology, which I know some industry participants are still continuing to push. I'd like to think our goal is to be on the forefront of that, but it just creates far more transparency. You know, groups that look to the underlying collateral, for instance, in order to mark their loans, that look at where prevailing loan spreads are, and surveys like yours are hugely helpful in bringing that transparency on where loan spreads are at any given point in time, and then ultimately marking to market if you've got fixed rate loans based on changes to underlying interest rates. But having a common valuation methodology, I think, would allow investors to have far more confidence in transacting at the net asset value that's set quarterly. And then I think beyond that, having a benchmark that becomes the industry standard would be huge in order to draw in more investors and to grow the pie for all of us. I think you've seen that same thing happen with the development of some pretty well-known indices on the core equity side for real estate. And that has led to kind of a transformation in the capital that they've been able to raise and the diversification they've been able to create as a result of that, the product innovation. And so I think a growing pie helps all within the industry. And I think those are two ways in which we could all help facilitate continued growth for commercial real estate lending, which will be in demand for years to come. And so I think the valuation methodology and the benchmark are two critical things that we need to solve, and that there's a lot of great work going on. I think we just need to choose a path and continuing to push the envelope on bringing more transparency to investors.
Those are two excellent points. Justin, thank you so much for being with us. I know for our listeners, we did mention two things, which we'll put in the show notes. First is a link to Justin's recent piece, Searching for Gold, as well as some info if you're interested in the Altus Debt Capital Markets Survey and learning more. You'll be able to find that info in the show notes below. But I think that's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.